CBS News presents Howard K. Smith from London. Today, the chief of Columbia's European news staff continues his discussion of the worldwide power struggle between East and West. By recording, we take you now to London and Howard K. Smith.
Peace is the supreme value, the thing most of us want most in the world today. The way to get it is to achieve armed strength from which to bargain for a settlement. That, briefly stated, is the theory of Western foreign policy at present. Those are the premises on which we have decided to stake everything to avoid war. Now, if those premises are valid, people should be feeling pretty happy and optimistic at present, for in the past week or two there has come a sudden plenty of indications of rising Western strength from which to bargain to achieve peace. Secretary of Defense Marshall has revealed that America's armed numbers have doubled in a ridiculously short time, and there's no let-up in the pace. Defense mobilizer Charles Wilson has reported miracles of production to equip those troops and the growing forces of our allies. Here in Europe this week, the second anniversary of the Atlantic Pact was celebrated, and by the agreement, General Eisenhower formally assumed command of the Atlantic armies. On the occasion, measures of the growth of Allied power were made by speakers, and to cite but one figure, it was revealed that the outlay on defense by the 12 Atlantic allies has tripled in amount just since the outbreak of the Korean War 9 months ago. All over the Atlantic world, numbers on paper 9 months ago are becoming soldiers, and arms for them are rolling off production lines. At the same time, the other quantity in the power relation that we must keep our eyes on, that is, the Russian power that we have set out to counterbalance, has undergone some interesting and rather optimistic for us reassessments over here in Europe. An assessment published in the Manchester Guardian the other day suggests that we may have been exaggerating the might of the Soviets for some time. On the highest estimate of Russian armed forces so far made, that made by the British Ministry of Defense recently, it appears that 2% of Russia's population is in arms. That, the Guardian pointed out, is about equal to America's proportion and not much higher than that of Great Britain. Also, a comment in the London Times said, "We have the habit now of computing our relative strength against that of Russia in terms only of ordinary divisions and standard weapons, and of leaving the atom bomb out of the accounting. If we put America's indubitable far superiority in atomic weapons into the scales, the West is very abundantly equipped with the kind of might that matters for influencing negotiations at the conference table." In addition to Russia's armed might now on foot, Russia's economic potential for fighting a war has undergone a reassessment. The United Nations Economic Commission for Europe recently published an inventory of world steel resources, the chief item in any war economy. And it came to the conclusion that steel production in the Atlantic bloc is 4.5 times that of the entire common form bloc, including Russia. And also that we have more facilities for rapid expansion of that production should war break out. The London Economist yesterday published a survey of all Russian industry as the first Soviet post-war five-year plan comes to an end. And the Economist commented, I quote, "Both the shape and the degree of the plan's achievement indicate that reconstruction rather than rearmament has so far been the major preoccupation." The Economist summed up its overall survey of Soviet economy with these words, "Thus, the picture at the end of the first post-war five-year plan is not that of a country fit and ready to go into the fighting ring. It is still far from that peak condition which would entitle it to make a bid for the world championship." Possibly it was comparisons of factors like these, the West's growing strength against the reassessment or the revaluation of Russian power, that induced Mr. Averell Harriman, President Truman's personal representative, to say day before yesterday that the initiative in the Cold War, so firmly in Russia's hands just 3 months ago, has now passed decisively to the West. On our premises, then, that strength makes for peace, there should be high optimism in the Western world. In fact, however, one notices the opposite here in Europe at present. I have gained the clear impression that uneasiness, worry about the prospects of peace, is deeper here now than it has been for a long time. In visits to three European countries recently, all the clues I was able to find to this paradox of Europe's malaise seemed to lead, as I expected, to Moscow, but they led there via Washington. Let me explain what I mean. Most people in Europe believe that Russia does not want a general war. She will exploit all our weaknesses that she can without danger to herself, but that she is deathly afraid of a general conflict with the West. However, it is thought here, if Russia should come to the conclusion that we have decided that war is inevitable, then it is feared Russia herself may attack. Well, the great fear here now is that the State Department may be giving Russia that impression, that we have decided that conflict is inevitable. For while America has the world initiative, as Mr. Harriman said, we are not offering to make any use of it at any conference table or at any theater of conflict. Our declared policy is to bargain from strength. The balance of strength is visibly shifting to us, yet we are refusing, both in Asia and in Europe, to do any bargaining, or even to state any terms on which we are willing to make a settlement. In Asia, for example, almost all of our United Nations allies have long favored stating the terms on which we would be willing to end the Korean conflict and make a general settlement with the Chinese communists. Some of our friends have written out tentative agenda for such talks, but we, or the State Department, have neither agreed to their terms or stated any terms of our own on which we would be ready to open talks. Now, with UN troops at and over the 38th parallel, the question has grown acute. For the past 3 weeks, our allies have been negotiating with the State Department in Washington to agree on a long-needed restatement of UN aims and policy in Korea. The department has agreed to join in a generalized policy statement, but it refuses to accede to the British request to offer to negotiate. The department's stony refusal to entertain any idea of talks is causing a new breach in the Allied front. And to be entirely frank about it, it is inducing a mistrust of our intentions and purposes. The dangerous impression is spreading, and certainly the Russians are ahead of our allies in Europe in believing it, that we consider bargaining to be now useless and conflict to be inevitable. The same impression is unfortunately being created at the center of European decision, the four-power conference now going on in Paris. It has been a wearisome conference with a very minor purpose to fulfill, simply to write a brief agenda of topics for the big four foreign ministers to talk about at a conference later in the year. Tomorrow, the conference goes into its sixth dreary week, with agreement on the agenda nowhere in sight. But, though the conference has been dull and its purpose secondary, 5 weeks of talks have revealed a couple of interesting and significant things. The first is, we of the West have at last got something the Russians apparently want desperately. We possess, namely, a disarmed Western Germany, and we have plans to rearm it. Every gesture and word of Mr. Gromyko in Paris has indicated that the Russians genuinely fear the harnessing of the mighty Ruhr district and the German population to our defense machine. And the Russians may be willing to pay a very high price to buy us off. Here then at last we're in a position of strength in Europe as in Korea. Here are the elements of a settlement. Here is the strength we wanted to bargain from. Let us, people here say, agree to an agenda and lay down our price. Unfortunately, the second significant impression of 5 weeks of talks in Paris is that Mr. Jessup of the State Department has no terms for settlement. The Russians, in order to keep the topic of German militarization high on the agenda, have yielded a good many points to us in the talks so far. At present, it is a ridiculous truth that on this key point of Germany, one semicolon keeps the West from agreeing with Russia on this all-important topic. The magazines of comment here in Britain this weekend are unanimous that we should now go ahead and accept the agenda. We've got the Russians, they say, in a spot. Now's the time to go ahead with negotiation. But Mr. Jessup goes on giving the impression that he is, in fact, afraid of the topic of German militarization, though our consciences are clear. He gives the impression that we have made up our minds that Germany must be rearmed, and that we are therefore unwilling to bargain from the best position of strength in Europe we have had since the war. Our friends at the conference table, Britain and France, go on supporting his position. But diplomats from both countries have told me privately that they consider our stand to be both wrong and dangerous. They refuse to say so in public because they rightly feel that the time is too crucial for any rift to be shown in the Western Front. The nature of the danger the diplomats saw was expressed the other day by the Manchester Guardian. If this attitude of the Western powers continues, the Guardian commented, and I quoted, the Russians may come to believe that we are unwilling to bargain, being so firmly fixed on rearming Germany. Should they come to that conclusion, they might well feel forced to come to other conclusions, to decide, perhaps, whether they ought to take preventive measures before our rearmament matures. That is the reason why, though the initiative in the world is now in Western hands, Europe is profoundly worried that peace, so near, may be lost. We have the strength to bargain from, but contrary to our stated policy, to our premises, to our theory, now that the advantage is ours, we are refusing to bargain. People outside the United States can come to one of only two possible conclusions. Either we don't know what we want, which means an unforgivable abdication of statesmanlike leadership in a time of crisis, or else that we have changed our basic policy. We no longer want rearmament to prevent war, but have decided that conflict cannot be avoided, and so there's no purpose in negotiating. Our European partners here are pretty sure that the former is the case. The State Department still believes peace can be made, but it's in a muddled condition due to internal attacks by the McCarthyites and due to the suddenness with which America has been handed the initiative. However, the Russians cannot be expected to be so trusting. They will inevitably incline to the latter theory, that we have decided that war cannot be avoided. Certainly, their paranoiac suspicions have had, in their own eyes, great justification from the activities of General MacArthur in the past few weeks. General MacArthur's statement of last week, it is now clear, was a conscious effort to prevent peace talks, which our UN allies were then planning. His letter this week to Representative Joe Martin was just about as near as one could get to a frank statement that he favors a general war in Asia. But the worst feature of these statements was not the fact that he made them. It was the fact that to this day, no repudiation of them has come from the makers of American policy in the State Department. What is, then, American policy? As a friend of the United States here in Britain said to me this week, not since Munich, probably, has there been such a flagrant abdication of leadership by our leaders. This is Howard K. Smith reporting from London. I return you now to CBS in New York.
You have been listening to the chief of Columbia's European news staff in a recorded broadcast from London. Howard K. Smith is heard each week at this time with a report and analysis of world events. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.